The IER podcast is produced by Creative Kin and sponsored by Thompson Solicitors. Thanks for listening.
Having the right to strike doesn't mean you have to exercise it. The point is to have the right in order that workers ultimately have got leverage in negotiations. And without the right to strike, they simply don't have that leverage.
Businesses, employers will be laughing at unions all the way through the process because they know that at the end of the day, they can keep the union out.
Hi, I'm James Harrison, Director of the Institute of Employment Rights. Welcome to the second part of our discussion on collective rights. Initially, we intended for this to be one episode, but we realised we had so much good stuff that we decided to split this episode into two parts. There is more of this discussion in the previous episode available now. Thanks to Thompson Solicitors for sponsoring the podcast. Please visit thompsonswithap.law/employment-bill to find out more from their team of employment law experts on the government's employment rights bill. So let's hear labour law experts Professor Keith Ewing and Lord John Hendy KC, our president and chairperson, continue their discussion on collective rights and the Labour Party's employment rights bill. So I'm aware there are other things that we want to touch on in this episode, so I thought we might move on to the right to strike. So in Labour's Green Paper on Employment Rights, the New Deal for Workers as well, it was a key commitment that the UK's industrial action law should be compliant with international law. And that commitment now appears to have gone missing. So what does the bill propose in relation to our law on strikes, John?
It certainly makes some useful proposals to ease the burden on unions in organising strikes. But just before we mention what they are, we should perhaps just state again the obvious, that the importance of the right to strike is not that unions, or still less workers, want to disrupt the economy or damage their employer. It's simply necessary that they have some bargaining leverage in negotiations in order to secure an acceptable deal, both for the workers, the unions, and the employers. And if you deny workers the right to strike, in effect, you're giving employers an absolutely unlimited power to cut, or at least to determine terms and conditions regardless of the interests of workers. So the right to strike, which is recognised across the world in all the major international human rights treaties, I think it's in the constitutions of some 80 nations across the world, the right to strike, and it's certainly to be found in some of the international obligations that the United Kingdom has voluntarily assumed, such as the ILO Convention 87, that's the International Labour Organization Convention 87. It's in the European Social Charter of 1961, which the UK has ratified in Article 6.4. It's in Article 8.1d of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights and so on. The right to strike is a fundamental human right. There's no question about that. Courts that deal with human rights, like the European Court of Human Rights, have recognised it as such. Our laws on strikes have become more and more restrictive, particularly as a result of the legislation passed by the Conservative governments in the 1980s. And the restrictions on exercise of the right to strike have been heavily criticised by the international bodies which supervise the international obligations that I've just mentioned. The bill does go some way to alleviate that. For example, unions currently have to serve a notice on an employer that they're going to conduct a ballot in favour of industrial action. And if they succeed in getting the necessary majority, then they have to serve a notice on the employer of the impending industrial action. the government have undertaken to simplify what's required in the notices, because at the moment the notices are hideously complex for unions. They've got to identify the number of workers, the categories of workers, and the workplaces of the workers, who they're going to ballot and subsequently who they're going to call on strike and so on. And it's very easy for unions to make a mistake on that, which will invalidate the ballot and hence make the strike unlawful. The government also proposing in the bill to permit electronic balloting. Currently, the situation is that unions have to send out voting papers by first-class post with a stamped addressed envelope for the worker to fill in the form and send it back to the union or the scrutineer by post, which is a heavy obligation. And today, I mean, few people use the post. So electronic balloting is what the Conservative Party use for determining their leadership, and most organisations now ballot electronically. So unions should have the same facility. There was a proposal also to allow workplace balloting, but there's no detail on how that is to be permitted. Obviously, workplace balloting has got to be secret, it's got to be secure, but it's unclear, to me at least, how that's going to be secured by the bill. What the bill doesn't do is to accommodate the criticisms that have been made of the legislation by the international bodies. And there are many of them. I just mentioned two by way of example. One is that in this country, solidarity action is not permitted. That's to say, workers on strike against their own employer are not entitled to call for solidarity action by workers employed by another employer. And the international bodies have been heavily critical of that, particularly the ILO and the European Social Charter. There's no proposal in the bill to permit that, even though the ILO specifically told the previous government that it ought to sit down with the social partners, that's to say the unions and the employers, to negotiate easing of the restrictions on solidarity action. One of the other recommendations is simplification of the legislation on industrial action. Now, this legislation is incredibly complicated. Few lawyers have managed to get their heads around it. And having spent many years trying to explain to judges what the intricacies of industrial action law in this country is, I can endorse that view. It is very, very complicated. And it needs to be simple. It needs to be so simple that any average worker and any average employer know immediately whether the strike is lawful or not without consulting lawyers, which is what employers invariably have to do.
What's that, Keith?
Yeah, I mean, just to pick up on that, I mean, there's just one point to emphasise, I think, which was, if you go back again to 2021, to the Labour Party policy, a new deal for working people, the commitment there was that a Labour government would legislate to bring British domestic law into line with international law. And as John has pointed out, international law requires us to make better provision to protect the right to strike than we currently do at the moment. Well, that seems to have gone by the board, which is not to deny that there are important provisions in the bill, in the sense that it repeals the Strikes Act of 2023, which deals with minimum service levels. It repeals most of the Trade Union Act of 2016, which was introduced by the then Cameron government. That's good. And there's some other little changes which were made to dismissal and actions short of dismissal. But you know, the restrictions on trade union freedom relating to the right to strike did not begin in 2016. And we can go back to 1980, 1982, 1984, 1988, and 1993. There are five other Acts of Parliament, which impose restrictions on the right to strike. And these provisions have been criticised by a range of international bodies, including the International Labour Organization, which is a UN agency based in Geneva, as well as by the Social Rights Committee of the Council of Europe, which is not an EU body. So they have consistently, not just once, but consistently on a regular cycle of scrutiny, criticised British law on these points. And you would have thought, for a government dominated by lawyers, that this would be an easy hit, an easy win. You know, so this is an issue about the rule of law, something quite fundamental, that, you know, the first obligation of government is to comply with the law. And that includes international law. Well, to comply with international law requires us to go back and look at some of these criticisms which have been made by these international agencies. I mean, this was an issue in the P&O case when, you know, 700-800 people were dismissed by their employer, but the union, denied by tight legal restrictions, banning the right to ask other workers to join them, other unions to join them, to support them in their campaign against P&O. I mean, the ILO Freedom of Association Committee, as John pointed out, highlighted that this is a continuing breach of ILO obligations and requested the government to set up some kind of review involving the social partners to come to some kind of resolution to address this problem. There is a compelling rule of law obligation on the government of this country to address the question of sympathy action as soon as possible. Now, the fact that they've dealt with, they claim, the P&O problem in the Employment Rights Bill is no answer to that obligation, not least because it's a continuing obligation to change the law, but also because the bill does not adequately deal with the P&O problem, despite all the hype to the contrary.
So what should the government be doing to meet its international commitments? And what would the tangible outcomes for workers be if they did?
The outcome for workers would be that it would be easier to take strike action. There'd be more protection for workers, and it would enable unions to organise industrial action more easily. I realise that that's not something that employers necessarily welcome, but the right, having the right to strike doesn't mean you have to exercise it. The point is to have the right in order that workers ultimately have got leverage in negotiations. And without the right to strike, they simply don't have that leverage. So what the bill ought to do is to go through all the criticisms of the international supervisory bodies, the ILO and the European Social Rights Committee, and make sure that the legislation addresses each of the issues. And there are a whole number of issues. Secondary action is only one of them. And they've been criticised now since 1989, consistently, as Keith says, on every cycle of supervision. And this is a rule of law issue. It's no excuse, as I've heard some say, oh, well, these international treaties can't be enforced as a matter of national laws. The lawyers call it domestic law. That's true. You don't expect to go to court and say, look, I've got a right here under ILO Convention 87. But that's not the point. The point is that a government that respects the rule of law should ensure that its legislation conforms to the international standards which it has voluntarily ratified and undertaken to be bound by. I mean, we've got a human rights lawyer as a prime minister. Surely there's no excuse for not making sure our law complies with international law.
I would say three things that would change if we fully complied. One is that the government would accept that it has a legal obligation under international law to promote effective recognition of the right to bargain collectively. If the government's accepted that responsibility, it would make a huge difference to the way in which collective bargaining was done. Secondly, out of the P&O case, there is a responsibility to take collective agreements much more seriously and to give them much better protection in our legal system. At the moment, they are not legally binding for historic reasons, but the ILO committee made it clear that the status of collective agreements needs to be looked at again, and the terms of collective agreements need to be observed and followed by employers, as in that case. And thirdly, on the right to strike, if we were fully to comply with our international obligations, three examples off the top of my head One, the purposes for which we can strike would be expanded, the restrictions would be removed. Secondly, the procedural obligations that have to be met would be relaxed. And thirdly, the right to support each other when in dispute would be restored, so we can engage in sympathy, secondary action to support other people when they are in dispute. So it would allow us to better counterbalance the power of the employer in the workplace.
I think that makes perfect sense. In terms of my experience of the world of work, work has got very little power, as I think we've said before. You know, it's all on a take it or leave it basis. And it would be nice to try and reset that dynamic a bit. And I think it would go some way to doing that. I'm aware time's ticking on and we probably want to touch on another couple of things. I know we wanted to talk about rights of access. So the bill says it'll give trade unions access to workplaces. So what are the conditions for and the purposes of such access? And are there international standards here or examples from other countries that we might work towards?
Well, yeah, there are provisions in the bill relating to access. There are other countries which have legislation dealing with access. I mean, the notable examples are Australia and New Zealand, though people say there are lots of other countries as well, but nobody actually puts the data on the table. But so far as the bill is concerned, what it's proposing is that unions should have access for the purposes of meeting, representing, recruiting, or organising workers, or to facilitate collective bargaining. And that is fantastic. That is really a good objective. But I think it was always naive to think that in our system, a union would be authorised to walk into premises at a reasonable time for these purposes. I mean, the extent to which our system, our common law, protects the right of private property, I think has been greatly underestimated. So what we have in the bill then is a proposal whereby for these access purposes, a union should seek an agreement with the employer. Well, you can do that already. If the union does seek an agreement and the employer says no, then the union can take a complaint to the CAC, the Central Arbitration Committee, and the CAC will have the power effectively to impose an agreement on the employer. If the employer refuses to comply with the agreement or the imposed agreement, then the union can go back to the CAC. And the CAC can order the employer to allow the union access in a prescribed way. If the employer still refuses to comply with the order, then the union has to go back to the CAC and ask the CAC to impose what is effectively a civil penalty on the employer. But that civil penalty doesn't go to the union by way of compensation for the loss of its right of access. It goes to the government. So basically what the legislation is proposing is that the union will have a right of access, but it will have no enforceable right of access, and it will have no compensation for the loss of its right of access, but there will be a sanction on the employer, provided that the union acts as some kind of law enforcement body on behalf of the state to impose a penalty, which then goes to the employer. Now, of course, no rational union will be incentivized to go back to the CAC on this third occasion. In order to have a penalty imposed on the employer. We don't know what the size of the penalty will be. The union gets nothing for it. It's got to invest legal resources, money and time into a process for which there will be no beneficial outcome for the union. So at the end of the day, as it's drafted, this is a procedure which has been drafted to fail. We have similar arrangements, similar remedies, stroke sanctions in the information and consultation regulations. These have been in operation since 2004, so that's 20 years. I think there are only two cases where a union in 20 years has gone to the CAC to have an order imposed on the employer because the employer has failed to comply with the regulations in question. And I would imagine much the same. Well, there might be a little flurry of activity just after the legislation is introduced, but eventually this will be a dead letter because it will achieve nothing and there will be no outcome for the union that will be worth pursuing. So I would say this is a great, important initiative, but we need to go back to the drawing board to ensure that there is some way by which an employer can be required to allow union access to its premises. And unless an employer can be required by law to allow the union to have access, then this won't work.
So it could be an onerous and sort of punitive measure on unions, and businesses may end up just seeing it as a cost of keeping unions out of their workplace, essentially. Well,
businesses, the employers will be laughing at unions all the way through the process because they know that at the end of the day, they can keep the union out.
Anything to add to that, John?
Yeah, well, what's needed, obviously, is the remedy that employers always go for in relation to industrial action. They go for an injunction. They get a court order requiring the defaulting party to comply. And if the union in the strike case doesn't comply, it becomes liable for contempt of court proceedings, which can be fines or even imprisonment. That's the sort of remedy that's required here against employers that fail to provide the reasonable access prescribed by the Central Arbitration Committee. And there's one other issue here, which Keith has outlined the legal proceedings that might follow. One can see immediately that this will be used by bad employers to delay the process. It's going to be difficult for a union to show a time constraint imperative requiring the legal proceedings to be brought in a very fast timescale. I can see employers like Amazon spinning out these proceedings by endless appeals to the Employment Appeal Tribunal, thence to the Court of Appeal and so on, in order to delay and frustrate unions' attempts to gain access to the premises. So I'm with Keith. This is a great initiative, but it needs real tightening up legally if it's to prove effective.
Just briefly then, before we move on to our final topic, any international examples where it works well? I know when we spoke recently with Michael Wood from New Zealand, who talked a little bit about it, but I wondered if this proposal compares to the New Zealand model and maybe other models around the world that might be more effective.
It compares unfavourably to the Australian model. They've got a right of access. Under the system there, the union official has to be certified or approved, so some kind of official status, which is fine. I mean, I get that. And then they have a right of reasonable access to the workplace. There's no formality of having to go to the Fair Work Commission or anything like that. It's a freestanding right, which the individual union official has. Now, speaking to friends in the Australian labour movement, I mean, they complain about this system doesn't work as effectively as it should, but it's much better than what we've got. But the problem for us is that we can't have that system, because if we were to allow a union official to knock on the door and to enter, you're going to have all kinds of human rights complaints from employers. I mean, it's a violation of the right of privacy, violation of the right to private property. And you can just see, you know, what would be coming down the line. So quite apart from these kind of fundamental common law objections that go way back to cases in the 18th century about the sanctity of private property in our kind of constitutional arrangements, which will be very, very hard, I think, to overcome. And I think the problem, and you just compare the Australian system, powers of entry are regarded as quite extreme, and they do require specific legal authority. Now, we're never going to do that here. We'll never get to a position where trade unions have the same power as public officials with these rights of entry and access. So we've got to be stuck with this kind of application, reference the CAC, but we've got to make it work better.
Okay, then, well, we've got a few minutes left. I just wondered if we wanted to touch on what we've talked about in the past as being a Ministry of Labour and the importance of that, having the machinery of governments, I think, as you said previously, Keith, about making sure we have a minister in charge of these things and having the proper government apparatus around it. So the government have set up this Fair Work Agency within the Department of Business and Trade. I believe there's around 150 staff that have been or will be redeployed from other government departments. So how effective do we think that it's going to be? Do we think it's going to be resourced appropriately enough to be able to undertake the work that it needs to do? And is it sitting under the Department for Business and Trade the most appropriate place for this machinery of government to exist?
Well, we have to distinguish. The Fair Work Agency is simply an inspection body with certain powers attached to it. It's not a Ministry of Labour. So Keith has already mentioned the importance of a Ministry of Labour in British history, dating back to 1918. And the fact is that we have no Ministry of Labour now. I think we're the only or one of the only developed nations on earth that hasn't got a Ministry of Labour. Even the United States has got a Department of Labour. So this bill is being dealt with not by the Ministry of Labour, because it doesn't exist, but by the Department of Business and Trade. Well, that gives you an inkling immediately about whose interests they're going to look to first before the interests of workers. So I agree we ought to have a Ministry of Labour. There's no such proposal in the bill, and I can't imagine that the government would entertain a proposal that there should be. In any event, it couldn't be done by way of amendment to the current bill for constitutional reasons. Coming to the Fair Work Agency, that's a body which is going to deal with labour market enforcement, taking over from the gangmaster's authority. Its powers to intervene are restricted to the legislation for those particular bodies. So it's not a labour inspectorate, as the International Labour Organization would understand, with the power to intervene on workers' behalf in respect of all their statutory rights. It's only a very, very narrow number of rights which are provided by statute, prevention of modern slavery and trafficking and that sort of thing. So I think that's a bit disappointing, because the original document that we've spoken about, the Labour Party document of 2021, A New Deal for Working People, looked to set up a single enforcement body covering all aspects of workers' rights, including health and safety at work. So all would be merged into one, because, of course, the labour inspectors that go to look, for example, at the consequences of an accident which has been reported at work, also see other things like underpayment of wages and refusal to give holiday pay and all sorts of things. And they could bring them back to the office and deal with them appropriately. So I think it's a bit unfortunate that the remit of the Fair Work Authority is not wider. There are also problems with the powers of the Fair Work Authority. Keith has already mentioned they've got power to enter premises and so on, seize documents and interview witnesses and so on. But what they haven't got is the power to prosecute, unlike the Health and Safety Executive, which has got the power to bring its own prosecutions, although many of them are delegated to the CPS or the Crown Prosecution Service. But it has got the power to prosecute. You've mentioned 150 staff. That is a long, long way short of the number of labour inspectors recommended by the International Labour Organization. Is this body going to have the sufficient staffing and sufficient funding really to carry out its obligations to protect the statutory rights of workers? Or is it simply going to be left as it is at the moment for workers to bring their own cases, aided by a trade union, if they happen to be in a trade union and the union's got the resources to represent them? Or is it simply going to be left to individual workers to fend for themselves?
Anything to add to that, Keith?
I would say that it's wholly inadequate, even as an enforcement body. And I think one of the tests of this bill is, once it's in force, how would it have dealt with a problem like P&O? Would the outcome in P&O have been the same, or could it have been the same, if this legislation had been in force? There are various failures of the bill in relation to P&O. But one of them is the fact that there is nobody who could step in and say to the company, you can't do that. I mean, this appears to be a breach of various legal obligations, consultation, unfair dismissal. And in that case, you can't do this. I mean, in the sense, you've got to comply with the legal obligations, and then we'll think about, you know, replacing or whatever you want to do. But if you look at this new body which they're contemplating, perhaps it could have stepped in and said to P&O, well, you can't do this. But as John said, there's no power to prosecute, but it does have the power to apply for a labour market enforcement order. And so it can apply to a court for an order, looking here at Clause 88, which prohibits or restricts a person from doing anything set out in the order, right? So in a sense, that would be a good vehicle. In a sense, somebody could go to court on behalf of a government agency to stop it from acting in a way which appears to be unlawful, but only in relation to these items which are listed, which, as John says, you know, modern slavery, gang masters, licensing act, minimum wage and working time regulations. But it completely ignores the whole framework of labour law otherwise. And that is a very compelling sense of the very limited vision and ambition of the government in creating this new body. It's inheriting powers from an existing body. It doesn't have greatly extended remits. I mean, it's really looking at a half a dozen or so core issues, but it doesn't spill into or empower the body to actually to intervene where there are other major abuses taking place, for example, of the kind that we saw at P&O. So that's another example of how the P&O case could be repeated despite the provisions of the bill, and there would be nobody there able to intervene to stop it.
Chilling thoughts.
Just to say that there are two sides to enforcement of rights. One is you can have a state authority which can prosecute or make labour market enforcement orders or fines or whatever, and inspect and so on to cover all these rights, which is one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is to have extensive collective bargaining coverage where disputes can be referred to the collective agreement disputes procedure and resolved by negotiation between the unions and employer. If they can't be resolved locally, then they're dealt with regionally, and if they can't be dealt with regionally, they're dealt with nationally. And so many of the issues raised in this bill could be resolved by collective bargaining. And to leave it really as a legal solution, but without giving workers the legal support of a state body to run the cases for them, it seems to me to make a mockery of the extension of rights. And it's not as if the government was going to extend legal aid to workers who are seeking to enforce their rights. I just point out that I was reading on my way here the economic analysis provided by the government of the Employment Rights Bill, which recognises the widespread failure to conform to existing rights, the extent to which workers are not given the paid holiday to which they're entitled under the working time regulations, or not paid the national minimum wage. But these people are not going to have a remedy provided for by the legislation. In fact, in relation to the national minimum wage, they will, but not in relation to all the other rights that are provided by statute.
There's plenty to cover, isn't there? And unfortunately, I think we've run out of time today. But thanks to our expert speakers, Professor Keith Ewing and Lord John Hendy KC, for sharing their knowledge and experience with us and for taking time out of their busy schedules to be part of this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, please consider subscribing to it. The IRR's an array of written and educational resources on our website, www.ier.org.uk. If you'd simply like to learn more, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Thanks again to Thompson Solicitors for their kind support for this podcast. And thanks also to you, the listeners, for being part of our new podcast. Please join us for future episodes and be part of the debate.
This podcast is sponsored by Thompson Solicitors and it's produced for the Institute of Employment Rights by Creative Kin. To find out more, visit creativekin.co.uk/IER.